Welcome to the radio broadcast of Mount Calvary Baptist Church. Your Bible teacher today is Pastor Jesse Wagoner.
And in this prophecy that we have today, it's the prophecy of the ram and the goat. It's probably not one of the more familiar or famous of the prophetic sections from the book of Daniel, but indeed it is important for us to get the grand scope of it. In chapter 7, we had the prophecy of these beasts that come up, the four beasts, and he interprets them at the end. And we know that that is the scope of the world-dominating Gentile empires that would rise throughout the days of history. Now we look in chapter 8. This prophecy is more close in. It basically covers the period of time from the time of Daniel to really the beginning, basically, of the New Testament, or nearly so, covering the two of those four kingdoms. And we want to begin in an unusual place. I want you to look at the last verse of the chapter, if you will. We're actually going to see this reaction of Daniel, and then we will go back and look at the prophecy that elicited this reaction. But I want you to see, because here's where the application lies, and here's where it gets personal with us. Verse 27, Daniel 8. "And I, Daniel, fainted and was sick for days afterward. I arose and went about the king's business. I was astonished by the vision, but no one understood it." If you take the first of that verse and the last of that verse, it's sort of weighty, isn't it? He was so moved by the significance of this vision, primarily because it is very bad news in days yet future for his own people. He says, "I fainted. I ran out of energy. I couldn't stand." And then he says, "I was sick for many days." So he had the weight of what he was experiencing and what he knew would be true. It just knocks the props out from under him. And then the very end of the verse, it says, "I was astonished at the vision." I don't have words. I don't have any categories. I don't have anything to even bring any perspective to this. I was astonished. And then he says this, "But no one understood it." Many parts of this was just, "I'm unable to process." Well, with all of that, I want you to look at the middle part of the verse, because this is where it hits home. Here's what he did. Here's the action he takes because of those set of circumstances. He says, after he'd been sick for days afterwards, he says, "Afterward I arose and went about the king's business." He just got up and went back to work. In essence, that's what God wants us to do when the life knocks the props out from under us, when we have no categories to explain it, when we are just left with little understanding, when part of what we experience in life sickens us. God just wants us to get up and go back to work. Interestingly, it says he was about the king's business. That would have been Belshazzar, the king, the then king of Babylon. But you understand, Daniel was placed in a particular place that while he served a king, he was serving the king. And that's what God wants us to do. While we serve whoever it is we serve the King of Kings. So I just begin with this very simple idea. We need to serve where you're placed. Wherever you're placed, wherever you are in life, whatever your work is, whatever your task is, that is your place to serve Almighty God. For some of us, that's the job we go to on Monday morning. And you might say, "Thank you for ruining my Sunday by reminding me of Monday morning, Pastor." But nonetheless, we go to work. Whether you go, if you're in school, that's your primary task. If you go to the job, if you're running the business, if you're a homemaker, if that's the center and you're raising children, that's your task. Whatever the task is, whatever God's given us to do, we do it for Him. When I think of Daniel in verse 27, I think of the generation, and we're blessed to have this generation with us. Many of them are still with us, and that's those folks that are in the high 80s and past 90 today. We have a number of them as part of our church family. They continue to be a blessing of seeking to serve and prayer warriors. They know how to love a pastor, I will tell you that. But I've tried to describe this generation, and oftentimes because of the length and the life expectancy, oftentimes I'm conducting funerals from folks of that generation. And I describe them this way. They were a generation, first of all, that grew up fast. Things called such as the Great Depression and a world war suddenly you had to grow up and take responsibilities long before most generations afterward would take up those adult responsibilities. They grew up fast. They're also a generation that didn't and does not complain much. My father's generation, many of them World War II veterans of his era, and they just didn't talk about it. They just came home and went to work, raising their families and doing being about their business. They didn't complain. They also are people who worked hard. Their work ethic was intact and worked hard and long and didn't think anything of it. They are also people who are just people who stayed by the stuff, who are resilient. They're also people that I found out do not have any trouble forming an opinion either. I figured that out about that generation. But basically, they're people with that life dealt them a difficult hand at an early age, and what did they do? They got up and they went to work, and work they did. Let's talk about that this morning and about serving where we're placed. Now, I'm just going to go briefly through this prophecy, and then I'm going to give you 3 points. It's going to be a long time before you write anything else down if you're taking notes, so just understand that. But verse 1, chapter 8 says this, "In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar," if you remember 7:1, that was in the first year of King Belshazzar. So 2 years later, God gives them this more detailed, narrow vision. "A vision appeared to me, Daniel, after the one that appeared to me the first time," verse 2. "I saw in the vision, and so it happened, while I was looking, that I was in Shushan, the citadel, which is in the province of Elam. And I saw in the vision that I was by the river Ulal." And so he lifts up his eyes and he sees in this vision, he recognizes a geographic location. We would call this in more common terms the city of Susa. It's about 230 miles east of Babylon, about 150 miles above the Persian Gulf. It was a notable city, and he sees himself there, and then God starts to unfold this vision, and it seems rather strange, as most of these visions do. He says in verse 3, "Then I lifted up my eyes and saw, and there standing beside the river was a ram, which had two horns, and the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher one came up last." So there's this ram with horns. Now, you remember we've talked about how that seems strange to us to have these different qualities associated with kingdoms and animals, but it was very common in their culture, and God speaks to that culture that was the first recipients. In fact, let me show you a picture. This is a reconstruction of a thing. Is there not a picture? There you go. Thank you. And notice now, this is a lion, but this actually comes from Susa. But notice what's sticking out of his head, his ram's horns. So they were very used to seeing things pictured in the personification of creatures and beasts and animals. So he sees this ram come up, and he describes it this way. Verse 4, "I saw the ram push westward, northward, and southward, so that no animal could withstand him, nor was there any that could deliver from his hand. But he did according to his will and became great." And then we have the second beast in verse 5. "And as I was considering, suddenly a male goat came from the west across the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground. And the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. Then he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing beside the river, and ran to him with furious power." So there's about to be a battle between these two creatures, these two animals. Verse 7, "And I saw him confronting the ram. He was moved with rage against him, attacking the ram, and broke his two horns. And there was no power in the ram to withstand him. But he cast him down to the ground and trampled him. And there was no one that could deliver the ram from his hand." So you have one kingdom pictured. And by the way, the kingdom of the ram is equal with the silver arms and the breast of that image that Nebuchadnezzar saw in chapter 2. It's equal to the bear of chapter 7, and here he's described as this ram. The goat is the second kingdom that comes. That's equal to the belly and the thighs, the brass belly and thighs of chapter 2, and the leopard with four wings of chapter 7. So it's recounting that, but just going a little deeper into the detail. So we have one kingdom, and then another kingdom arise and defeat it. And then he makes this statement, verse 8, "Therefore the male goat grew very great. But when he became strong, the large horn was broken." So the horn picturing a king of this kingdom. "And in the place of the four notable, and in place of it, four notable ones came toward the four winds of heaven." So you have a kingdom with a king. After he dies, you have four different kings ruling in that same era. This is all going to be interpreted beginning in verse 15, so stand by. But verse 11 and 12 are important because it gives us the reasons for these kingdoms rising. Look at these verses that come. It says, verse 9, let me read it there. "And out of one of them came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land." Of these four kings, one is going to rise, and notice what it says, and it grew up to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host and some of the stars to the ground and trampled them. So this is a high, exalted person in his own thoughts. "He even exalted him as high as the prince of the host. And by him the daily sacrifices were taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down." That's where Daniel's stomach would have turned. Because we don't read it with all the sensibilities he has, but what he's saying is there's going to be this future Gentile leader that's going to come and make the sacrifices in the yet restored temple cease, and going to trample underfoot all the holy things. We can imagine if we came to church this morning and this place set aside for the worship of God, if someone had come in the night and destroyed it and defaced it, we'd be sickened by that. Well, just multiply that by a factor of about 1,000, and that's how Daniel would have felt when he realized there would be one who would trample under the holy things of God. Verse 12, very important. "Because of the transgression, an army was given over to the horn to oppose the daily sacrifices, and he cast truth to the ground. He did all this and prospered." Why did it all happen? Because of the transgression. That's what he says right there in the text. This all happened because of sin. And by the way, let me just say this. Sin is the problem. It is the problem from which all other problems of humanity have their genesis. And by the way, I'm glad that we serve a Lord who has revealed in His Word that there is a solution for the problem of our sin. And the solution to the problem of our sin culminated when Jesus Christ, God's only Son, sinless as He was, gave His life to die on the cross to make sin's payment. And now He invites you and invites me to come and put our faith in that for our eternal salvation, to have our sins forgiven. But it says in verse 13, Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one who said to that certain one who was speaking, "How long will the vision be concerning the daily sacrifices and the transgression of desolation, the giving of both the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot?" He said to me, "For 2,300 days, then the sanctuary shall be cleansed." So a definitive length of time, which was literally fulfilled in history already past. I'm glad verse 15 and following is here, because it tells us what this is all about. "Then it happened, when I, Daniel, had seen the vision and was seeking the meaning, that suddenly there stood before me one having the appearance of a man. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ui River, and I called and said, Gabriel, make this man understand the vision." By the way, here his prophetic tour guide, if you want to call him that, is first named in the Bible. Yes, that is the same Gabriel, the same angel that was dispatched to Mary to announce the conception and the arrival of Jesus Christ to her. He always pops up when he pops up in the Bible to deliver a message. So Gabriel said, "Tell him what this is all about." Verse 17, "And he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was afraid and fell on my face. But he said to me, 'Understand, son of man, that the vision refers to the time of the end.' And as he was speaking me, I was in deep sleep with my face to the ground, and he touched me, and I stood upright. And he said, 'Look, I'm making known to you what shall happen in the latter time of the indignation, for at the appointed time the end shall be.'" So get ready. Fasten your seatbelt, Daniel. Let me tell you what this is all about. Verse 20, "The ram which you saw having the two horns, they are the kings of Media and Persia." All right, now he's writing this while Belshazzar is king. The Babylonians are in power. The next kingdom that comes is the Medo-Persian Empire. Before it happened, he already tells the history. I've shown you this slide before, but it shows the breadth of the Medo-Persian Empire when it was fully intact, reaching from all the way from the borders of Greece all the way eastward, to the Indus Valley and on the borders of modern-day India, all the way south down through what we know as the area of Israel, all the way into Egypt and into North Africa. It was huge. It was prominent. And he says, he calls it by name. Do you not find that fascinating, that God in advance tells exactly who's going to win, who's going to be where, and what's going to happen? Now track with me for just a moment. If God told what was going to happen before it happened, and it happened exactly as he said it would, then the things that he says yet will happen just as he says they will. You can count on what he says. This is accurate. This is true. This is reliable. This is dependable. And it played out in the past, and it will continue to play out exactly as God dictates it in the future. And the male goat is the kingdom of Greece. The large horn that is between its eyes is the first king. Well, just open your history books and figure out where Greece is. You see it in that picture as being that little green area to the far left. But basically, in 3 years' time, Alexander the Great swept the entirety of the Persian Empire and ruled in a brief period of time. The most what is considered one of the most probable likenesses of Alexander the Great is this statue, which is found in the Louvre Museum in France. But interesting of this man, Alexander the Great, he took on the Persian Empire even though the Persian armies outnumbered him. Everyone would have expected he didn't stand a chance, this little area conquering this big area. But he was a military genius. He used tactics and were advanced for the time. And he just stormed all across that area. He died at the age of 32. It wasn't like this was a long period of time. It was a sudden flash across the pages of history. And it says that this first king is represented in this horn. So that has played out exactly as it was. Now, he gives some more information. As for the broken horn and the four that stood in its place, four kingdoms shall rise out of that nation, but not with its power. At age 32, when Alexander the Great dies, interestingly, he dies while he was in residence in the palace of Nebuchadnezzar in Babylon. Sound familiar? A place where Daniel moved and lived in days past by the time that took place. But he dies early, and he doesn't leave very clear instructions about what's to happen, because most of us probably aren't thinking too much about writing a will at age 32. But nonetheless, it divides into four ways. Four of his generals take power: Ptolemy, Seleucus, Lysimachus, and Cassander. And they take different sections of his empire and continue the Grecian rule for a period of time. The one that most concerns us are the Seleucids, which covered the area of Palestine. Because under the Medes and Persians, after 70 years of captivity, Israel goes back, rebuilds the temple, re-inhabits the land of promise, and everything seems to go well for a while. Look at verse 23. This is the part that really grips him and sickens him. And in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their fullness, a king shall rise, having fierce features, who understands sinister schemes. His power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. He shall destroy fearfully, and shall prosper and thrive. He shall destroy the mighty and also the holy people. This is bad stuff. 25. Through his cunning he shall cause deceit to prosper under his rule. And he shall exalt himself in his heart. He shall destroy many in their prosperity. He shall even rise against the prince of princes. He shall be broken without human means. The eighth ruler of the Seleucid kingdom, if you want to say it that way, was a man that we know as Antiochus IV. And I would encourage you to look up somewhere online something about him. Here's one image of him. This is a coin that he had minted during his lifetime. He had his face on one side of the coin. On the other side of the coin, he had a Greek inscription, which if you translate it into English, King Antiochus, image of God, bearer of victory. He was a very humble sort, wasn't he? He was, and it says that right in the text. He was lifted up with pride. In fact, he is known to history as Antiochus Epiphanes, because that was a title he had in his day. Epiphanes means the revelation of God. So basically, he went around calling himself, "I'm Antiochus, the image, the revelation of God to you all." He had visions of delusions of grandeur and divinity. He was ruthless. It tells us in history that he set up an image of Zeus in the temple of God and commanded people to worship. You imagine about the monotheistic Jews being faced with that. Think about their clean and unclean animals and the sacredness of the sacrifice. He would bring pigs in and had pigs sacrifice, blood sacrifices on the altar of the Jews. He passed legislation that, think about this from the Jewish context, if any family had their male children circumcised, both the father and the child could immediately be executed for doing that thing that God commanded. And for nearly 6 years, he run roughshod over Israel. Now, Daniel's getting this in advance until suddenly, without any hand, without any army, he dies. There's actually multiple accounts. There's one account of history that says he fell off a boat and drowned. The book of the Maccabees, the Maccabeans said that he died of a terrible disease in his digestive organs and died in agony, and basically implied good riddance, glad he died that way. That's kind of what they were thinking. But regardless, God strikes him down. Now, after all of that, we're back to verse 27. I told you it would take us a while to get here. And I, Daniel, fainted and was sick for many days afterwards. I'm going to share with you three things and three applications for us based on verse 27. Number one, ultimate restoration awaits the coming of Christ. Ultimate restoration awaits until Jesus is here. We have to wait for the things to be as they will be. Jesus is coming. We may wish his coming would be now, but we wait for whenever God dictates that that time is perfect. But what do we do now? Look at verse 27. While we faint, and he was sick for days, what did he do? I arose and went about the king's business. What do you do while we wait? You simply do that. Take care of business while you wait. Get up and go to work. And by that, I mean just literally that. Get up and go to work. Wherever God has placed you. If you're in school and you go to school, that's your work. If you go to the place where you serve in a corporation or a company, that's where you work. If you're currently in a place where you don't have that employment, your job is to keep seeking and what God has for you and put yourself in the best position you have to find work. You remember in the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve living in perfection. God says, I want you to tend this garden. They had work from day one. Work is part of God's blessing to us. So when you go to work tomorrow, whenever you're or whatever's next, or if you reach a retirement stage, you kind of recalibrate to a different endeavors, hopefully productive and for the glory of God. But nonetheless, we give ourselves to work. Let me just share a couple things with you. As you take care of God's business while you do your own business or the business of your work life, maybe God is putting you in a place where you can influence way beyond what you think. Daniel never expected when he was hauled off to Babylon that he would ever accomplish great things. And here we are studying his book 2,600 years later, and God revealed things to Daniel that was revealed to no one else. If it hadn't been for Daniel receiving them, we would be in the dark about many, many things. Maybe God has you in a place where there's someone that shares the cubicle with you, or someone that is right down the table in the shop with you, or wherever it is, or shares the lunchroom with you, that maybe God has you placed there to influence them. You may think, well, that's not a big thing. Well, let me do a little equation with you. Take one soul saved for eternity. You take one soul, multiply it by eternity, and that's a very significant outcome, isn't it? Maybe God has you in that place. He influenced way beyond what he thought. If we are taking care of God's business while we wait for his restoring of all things, maybe we'd say it this way. Maybe he's giving you skills that you can use down the road in a different way. If you saw the article was in the paper this week about the Samaritan's Purse and the project that we're involved in here, back on page, whatever it was, back in there, you saw a picture of a man named Vic Floner. And he was overseeing the job site when the photographer took the picture. Vic is from Clearwater, Florida. He's been here for about 2.5-3 weeks now, serving in capacity. Vic is a car mechanic. He's like A1 certified, whatever you get for being a car mechanic. He's a good one, okay? He's already left the premises. That's why I told the people in the early service, see him if you have car problems after church. He'll fix you up. But he's an auto mechanic. But he also told me that God is giving the skills that he learned on the job. He literally has been all around the world when missionaries have, equipment problems, big equipment, heavy equipment, trucks, buses, these sort of things. He gathers the parts together and figures it out, flies over there and fixes their vehicle because he's the ace mechanic. He told me, I said, tell me all the countries you've been in, Vic. He gave me this long list. I forget how many countries it was. He said, yeah, and I probably forgot a few. He says, my wife threatens to take my passport away from me all the time to keep me home. God was preparing him to do something far greater. Maybe God's preparing you to do something great. God can use you. Stay busy for him. Secondly, ultimate unpleasant consequences for sin will continue. Basically, that's why he says, I was sick afterwards. Oh, our people are going to be destroyed. They're going to be punished because of their transgression, as he mentions in verse 12. He also mentions later in this chapter about, he uses the word indignation. God was not fully done with dealing with Israel, even though they are restored back to their land during the time of the Persians and the Medes. What do you do when there's still sin? And we see it all the time. We struggle with it in our own selves. We see families in conflict. We live in a world both locally and globally that is violent and scary, and our security is threatened. Here in our own area, the effects of addiction and violence and crime is around us. We don't ever seem to escape it. What do we do when we have these continuing consequences of sin? Here's what you do. You just take care of business, even in spite of your hurts. What is the business? Here's what it says. I arose and went about the king's business. He went back to work. What if we woke up and whatever our work is, if we could just approach it fully with this intact? Lord, I have the opportunity to do whatever it is. Do this for you, for your glory, to see it as significant. You know, it would do a couple things if we had that. First of all, it would make every day an adventure. Yeah, I'm doing this thing that I do, and it might be sometimes boring, and it might be sometimes drudgery and that sort of thing. Or maybe you just fully enjoy what you're doing. If you are, God bless you. But to say, Lord, what do you got in today's little package of events in my work life that is going to be useful for you for eternity? We long for adventurous people. In the last couple, 3 years, they put up this place down on the New River Gorge on the edge of it where you can hook yourself to a wire and you can zip out through the heights and the trees and sail through the air. Someone asked me, Pastor, are you going to go try that? I said, no, I get enough adrenaline in life. I don't need more of it by hanging on a wire or zipping through the air. Thank you very much. But we look for adventure. We look for the next Marvel action movie coming out. We need adventure. You want adventure? When you go to work next, make it your prayer. Say, Lord, what do you want me to do that's of eternal value for you today? Open it up. Show me. I'm ready. It'll make every day an adventure. Thirdly, unique opportunities remain for everyone. This opportunity that Daniel had to serve, be about the king's business, Belshazzar's business, put him in the place. Remember now, this is the Belshazzar of the handwriting on the wall story we looked at earlier in the book of Daniel. This is the one who brought the things that were stolen from the temple of God and offered toasts, if you will, to his idols and his false gods, and as if saying, we will not be defeated even by the God of the Hebrews. And a hand appears and writes words on the wall. Daniel interprets them, and before the night is over, the Medes take Babylon without a fight. Belshazzar is killed, and the kingdom switches just like that. Same Belshazzar. He was in the unique place to do God's bidding and to do God's will. Maybe God has you in an absolutely unique place where no one else could fulfill that. We need to find satisfaction in that and comfort in that and joy in that. You see, because that is a place that could even be a worshipful place. You mean my work can be worship? Yes, it can. If you approach it from the attitude and the heart that says, Lord, I do what I do. Yes, for others. I do it for my customers. I do it for my employer. But I do it for your glory and yours alone. Paul writes when he wrote to the Corinthians, he says, whatever you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. I hope whatever's next in your work life, that you can approach it a little bit different. That we would simply, in the spite of the things that make us faint or make us sick, or things that astonish us or things we don't understand, middle of verse 27, we'll do what Daniel did. I arose and went about the king's business. Now, he served a king, but ultimately he served the king. I leave you with this. Every day is a day to take care of the king's business.
You've been listening to the radio broadcast of Mount Calvary Baptist Church in Charleston. Mount Calvary Baptist Church is located at 1509 Bigley Avenue in Charleston, West Virginia. Worship services are at 9 a.m., 11, and 6 p.m. For more information, contact calvarywv.com.